Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Welcome to Vox Novus, the new voice. When someone close to me was receiving physical therapy for a back injury, this person was instructed by the therapist to use certain techniques in repetitions of 10. Not being familiar with the techniques, the question was asked about the source. The answer was Pilates. I recalled seeing references to Pilates at exercise studios throughout New York City, but never really explored this. Recently, I received a copy of a book entitled Caged Lion, Joseph Pilates and His Legacy. Imagine my amazement when I discovered that Pilates was actually a man's name and that today his techniques are practiced by more than 10 million people worldwide. My guest this week on Vox Novus is John Howard Steele. John Howard Steele practiced law for 60 years and Pilates for nearly as long. As one of the few people still alive who studied with and knew Joseph Pilates both in and out of the studio, he's in a unique position to tell this story. John Howard Steele has been interviewed in numerous publications and regularly lectures to teachers and studio owners on the history of Pilates. He lives in Santa Barbara with his wife, Bunny. He joins me this week to discuss his first book, Caged Lion, Joseph Pilates and His Legacy. Please join me in welcoming to Vox Novus, John Howard Steele. Welcome, John.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much.
And thank you. Now, before we discuss your initial meeting with Joseph Pilates, please share your early life path, your upbringing, and choice of a career in law.
Well, that's the first time this has been asked to me in connection with the book, but it is important. That's a good question. I was born in New York City, and my parents and my grandparents left New York about 1937-38 and moved to Florida, Miami Beach. And then as World War II was developing, they both got frightened. There were actually submarines off the coast of Florida, and we moved to North Carolina. And I lived there on a farm from, I guess, 1941 to 46, and then came back to New York City, where I started in public school, PS6, which had by then a well-established North Carolina accent. So I got laughed at quite a bit in class when teacher would call on me and I would say, yes, ma'am. And it eventually wore off, as it always does to people in New York. And I acquired what's now identified everywhere as a New York accent. And then I was sent away to military school in Indiana, Culver. And from there, I went to Princeton University, where I studied engineering, got a degree in engineering there. And from there to Columbia Law School, and I started practicing law. Right after I got out of law school, I actually practiced patent litigation for many years, and then I got a little tired of it, I guess. And then I just started practicing general law, and I worked for a firm in New York and did litigation for them. And I was in and out of a lot of firms. It was a difficult time for me in many ways. And along came Pilates at that time in 1963. I got out of law school in 59. And there was something about two aspects of it. One was the personality of Joseph Pilates, and two was the actual Pilates routine. Speaking about Joseph, he was somehow a beacon light for me to get out of what had become kind of a very insecure. I was very secure. My parents had enough money and I'd had a very good education. I didn't have a lot of debt, but I was quite lost in who I was. And there was no way that I could find out who I was within the social confines I was involved with, which was striving to be, you know, a hotshot New York lawyer and hotshot New York social person and all of that. And there was something about Joe which I couldn't articulate. It wasn't a conscious thing even, that represented a way to help me find myself. And so I was immediately attracted to it. At the same time, my first experience with Joe was very, very difficult. It was repulsive in many ways.
Now, we're gonna touch on that first meeting, but your parents, and especially your mother, were practitioners of Pilates. Tell us about them and how they introduced you to the practice.
Yeah, they were. And my father... my mother didn't work ever. She was a classical housewife mother at the time. My father worked as little as he could. He was quite lazy, actually. he was an absolutely wonderful man, extremely ethical and involved. But he was not very ambitious, and I could probably figure that out why, but it's not important right now. But they were sort of like retired people, and what they did was they kind of hooked on to weird, I called it weird stuff. In the early, late 50s and the early 60s, people who had kind of remedies for how to get along in life and guru types, and they went from one to another, and I'd hear about these things, and I'd think, wow, they're really nuts, and I was nuts in my own way, striving to be this hotshot lawyer, but... you know, these were sort of faddish things, many of which would have been much more prevalent in Northern California than they were in New York. But they had an ear for this. And they had my mother, who got to Joseph Pilates through a choreographer who she knew from, I think, college days. Got to him, and she became absolutely obsessed with this, like even to a higher degree than most of their other sort of crazy stuff. But this she was really nuts about. She demonstrated it to anyone who would listen to her. She had a wonderful figure. She was not very athletic, but she took excellent care of herself. And she was a beautiful woman. So she would say, oh, I'm doing this. And people would sort of look at her blankly. And I kind of looked at her disdainfully because there was something in me that thought, gee, my dad's got to be a little jealous of this. He's talking about this other man and how wonderful he is and how he manipulates her body and does it. And I thought, oh, that's got to be a little disturbing to my father, who I adored. And he didn't seem to mind. But, you know, I projected that out of him, and it was kind of funny. And then I did not have a very good relationship with my mother at that time, a brittle relationship. And my father was, he was very passive about that, very loyal to my mother. And so he was always troubled by it, but I would see him for lunch and see him here and there, and he was very proud of me being a lawyer and all that. So it was all right. But my mother, and I had this chronic stiff neck, and my mother kept saying, oh, you've got to go to this Mr. Pilates. He can fix everything. He fixes everyone. He's a genius. Yada. And of course, as a good son, I resisted that. But finally, I gave in, and I gave in not to get my neck fixed, but to get my mother off my back. I just was tired of hearing about this. And I went, and that's where the book starts, my first meeting with the famous at that time, to me, Joseph Pilates.
Now, how old were you and how old was he?
He was, it was 1963, so he was 80, and I was 28.
And was that meeting warm and fuzzy?
If there's anything that wasn't warm and fuzzy, this was it. He first place, he met me in the hall of the building, a big, very large brownstone on 8th Avenue in New York. He met me in the hall of the first floor. I had to buzz myself in, so he knew I was coming up, and he lived there in the studio, or what was then called the gym, was there. And he met me in the hall, and, you know, I was dressed. It was very early in the morning, 7:15 or something, and I was one of those ambitious people who got up very early. It wasn't a big deal for me, but I was all cleanly shaven and in my Brooksy Brothers-y kind of suit and tie and, you know, English shirt with a high collar and polished shoes. And he was in these shorts, no top. It was chilly, and ballet workout shoes were warm, just little canvas slippers, really. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I thought, well, he is a complete fake, just like I thought. And he's got my mother enthralled, but, you know, all right, so I'll get through this, and that'll be that. And I imagine, I never spoke to him about it, but I imagine he looked at me like, oh, God, you know, another spoiled preppy brat. I got to teach how to take care of himself and yada, yada. And that's how we started. He hardly had a word for me. He didn't want to hear anything about my stiff neck, never mentioned my parents. Just get to work, get changed, get on the reformer. And that's how we started. And I can tell you from as distinct a memory as I have of anything in my life, that feeling on my part left, abandoned me almost within 10 minutes. I mean, he captured my attention so thoroughly, and there was no room left to thinking about what a phony he was or this. I was like a puppy in his hands at that point. And that's how it stayed through the whole session. And that's where I started.
And what was that first session like?
Well, you know, it's hard to explain this in modern terms because people have seen or know about Pilates, but I didn't know the first thing about it. It wasn't called Pilates, then it was called Contrology. I knew it was some kind of physical exercise or therapy. And then when I looked in the studio and saw the equipment, which you couldn't imagine equipment in a gym that looked like this. The only thing I could imagine, you know, were barbells and weights and stuff like that. Not even the modern stuff that we see today, all these machines with weights and things. It was just bizarre. And of course, when he started and how he even taught was completely different than anything I'd ever experienced. And the routine, the choreography of the routine, was completely bizarre. It was, you know, it wasn't like push-ups or sit-ups or any of the things that you kind of know about as workouts or anything you learned competing in sports in college. It was just completely bizarre stuff, sitting down on a machine that he called the Universal Reformer, where what you sat on moved back and forth. And, you know, you had springs and foot bar and shoulder rests. So you were completely disoriented. And I guess now that we're talking, and you've asked me a question that brought this out in my mind, that disorientation forced me to follow him. There was no guidepost, nothing that I could hang on to as, okay, well, now he wants me to do push-ups. No, it was, and now he's telling me to do something with my legs on a foot bar with springs and a moving platform. And so it was always, every move I made was brand new and into some territory that, you know, I had even no imagination what it was. So that's what it was like. I just followed him tried to follow him very precisely. I listened with 100% concentration, and that was my start. And at the end, as I point out in the book, I was nauseous and threw up.
He had an aversion to weights and weightlifting, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He was very much opposed to anything that was strenuous. And weights were one of his pet peeves. He did not approve of weights or weight training or anything like it. He didn't want you to strain ever. And weights, I guess, represented to him a form of straining.
And you share an interesting story about how you asked him about how the repetition, the number 10, came about. What was his answer?
He wanted to know if I had anything against 10. It was like, what do you care, sort of thing. Is 10 a bad number for you? Is it the devil's number or something? It was with that kind of thing. But then later he explained that everything was geared to making it I don't know if I can get these words correct. He wanted you to disengage your thought process from what you were doing. And he explained 10 or any number in the fact that you had to think about a number. So he gave you one that was extremely easy. Everyone is very comfortable with 10.
So in essence,
that's where 10 came from.
In essence, what he was telling you is what they said, the advertising slogan that became big for a certain sports equipment company, just do it.
Exactly. Exactly. It was, he wanted your full attention away from the attention that you give when you're taking a course in Dostoevsky, or he didn't want you taking notes. He didn't want you trying to memorize anything. He didn't want you to have that part of your psyche working. He wanted in the foreground. He wanted to let that work in the background. And he wanted your body to start learning the routine, not your mind.
My guest is John Howard Steele. We're talking about his brand new book, Caged Lion, Joseph Pilates and His Legacy. John, please tell our listeners how they can get your book and find out more about you.
They can find out mine and the book's website, which is johnhowardsteele.com. Steele has no E at the end. And you can actually order, you can click through to Amazon from that website, or you can go straight to Amazon, or in these times, if you want to do a good thing, go to your bookstore and ask them. They have it or can get it in a day or so. And it's easy to get. It's a big seller right now on Amazon. So they've got it. And you can get it actually in about 30 countries.
Wonderful. And we'll be back with more of John Howard Steele and Caged Lion, Joseph Pilates and His Legacy, after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times. Co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
America, your children have an amazing superpower. That's right. They can help save lives by simply washing their hands. Just 20 seconds of thorough hand washing after they've coughed or sneezed or been outside can help fight against the dastardly spread of germs. Armed with only soap and water and hands, your superhero can protect you, your family, and everyone out there in America land. Amazing! Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
One in three adults has prediabetes. One in three. That means it could be you, your football buddy, your football buddy, or you, your best man, your worst man, you, your dog walker, your cat jogger. While one in three adults has prediabetes, with early diagnosis, prediabetes can be reversed. Take the risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org. That's doihaveprediabetes.org.
Wait, did they just say one in three adults has prediabetes? That's 33.33333% of adults. That means it could be me, my boss, or my boss's boss, or me, my favorite sister, or my other sister. That's seven members of my 21-person romantic book club. Wait, the one in three could be me, my karaoke partner Carol, or my karaoke enemy Jeff. I'm going to take the risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week, John Howard Steele. We're talking about his book, Caged Lion, Joseph Pilates and His Legacy. John, please share with us a little about Joseph Pilates' background and how he came to found his studio in New York City.
Yeah, that was a very difficult question for me to address when I was writing the book. When I started on this project, it was really only to lecture Pilates professionals at one of the early Pilates Method Alliance annual conventions. But when I realized that they didn't know much about Joseph Pilates, I was disturbed by that, because I had a deep affection, love for this man. And to think that 40 years or so after his death, a good part of them didn't even know that Pilates was a person, and that he'd gotten lost in this revival of his exercise routine. I realized they didn't know about him, but then when I started to think about it, which you have to do when you're going to put words on paper, I realized I didn't know anything about him. And so I started to look into it and do research, and I came to so many dead ends. Dead ends, not in the sense, not only in the sense I couldn't find more information, but dead ends in the sense that I had been misled by what I read, that it couldn't be right, that this didn't happen that, couldn't have happened that way. My inner lawyer got very busy at this stage, and I was constantly thinking about, you know, that it's like looking at the other side's argument. What are they saying? And, I mean, where's the chink in that? Where is it not right? And everything didn't make, nothing made sense, and nothing added any answer. So I started to try to find out about his background, and my wife, who is fluent in German, we were going to go there, and we were going to do some research, and even setting that up wasn't going anywhere. So that didn't seem like a good possibility. Then I came across a book written by a Pilates instructor, who a Spaniard, who I referred to in my book. And he'd written this, he went on a 7-year quest to find out about Joe Pilates' background. And he wrote this book. And it is, in the sense, a biography, but it's more in the sense of a recreated journal, like what he did every day or every week, and where he lived and who lived next to him. And it's sort of a very difficult book to sit down and read, but it had tons of information. I met this man, absolutely lovely man, in Barcelona. We had time together, we talked about it, and he had as many doubts as I had about the authenticity of Joe's story of his life, and he couldn't find answers to him either. So I was sort of confronted, as I am in answering this question, with what was his background? And I ended up saying I'm not capable of doing a biography. I don't have enough time, and number two, I believe it would be futile. He didn't leave any traces. So that was an important guidepost on what I was going to do. Why didn't he leave any footprints? Why can't you find out about Joseph Pilates' history in detail? There's nothing he wrote, no letters, no journals, no diaries, no records. So the gaps became the point of interest. And I had to sort of recreate what I thought were the important points of his life. It's not a biography in the sense that you can read about the man as he developed, or the person, or the woman, or the child, as they developed along and made changes in their lives, because there's no explanation for lots of physical things you know happened. You do know he did go to Great Britain, and you do know that he was incarcerated, and you do know that he came back to Germany for a very few years, and that he made two trips to New York, and that he made the second trip with Clara, and then you know that he established himself in New York, and that part is fairly easy to follow. But he was already in his 40s when he got back here. He was 44, and he had nothing. So I just try to connect the dots, and I acknowledge this right off in the book, that I'm not, you know, writing a factual biography, and I kind of work with it through what I knew personally of him and how he might behave. So anyhow, he gets to New York in 1927 with nothing, and really nothing, no background, no credentials, no money. The only thing he had was, before he left Germany, a very famous German ballerina named Hanya Holm, a dancer. She was not a ballerina. She was trained as a ballerina, but she was one of the first people to have pursued what was then called, and still called, modern dance. Anyhow, she had come to him for help, and he had helped her with some injury, and she was somewhat in the background. She still was in Germany. And he came to this country, and I think, I have no records of this, that through her he had some introduction to the New York ballet world. And I also think, and again, no proof, not even evidence, that she had come over from time to time to dance here, which had would have helped him get introduced. Anyhow, he got into the New York ballet world, and he had this amazing charisma and the skill or ability or talent or genius, some people call it, of being able to fix people's physical injuries. And that's where he started. And that's where he was from, and I got to him 37 years later, and that's where he was pretty much in exactly the same spot 37 years later, doing exactly the same thing. And that's pretty much, you know, we do know that he was greatly admired by a number of famous dancers. He was greatly sought after even by opera singers, because he could improve their air control and their breathing. And he had also developed other clients, and those were the people that I kind of knew went to the gym. When I did, among them, my parents. But it was a complete mom and pop operation in one facility. By the time I got there, there were two other very small, very private studios or gyms. They were studios in New York. One was in department store Bendel's, and the other was in a private home, a room in a private home. But that's where it had gone when I got there. So it's gone a lot farther lately.
Now, the practice was originally called Contrology. What was the philosophy he had behind these exercises and routines?
Well, his philosophy, which I think came out of his intuition, his philosophy was that if you could take care of your body, and if you could bring into consciousness how you moved and what it was to cause movement in your system through doing exercises, even through walking, anything you did in life was really his concern, you know, taking a pot off a shelf or throwing out the garbage or taking a shower, whatever it was all a movement that was important to understand how you were doing it, why you were doing it, and trick within your system that allowed you to do it. How did you trigger muscles? And anyhow, his philosophy was to get that integrated into your subconscious, maybe, but into your system, so that movement became a meaningful activity in your life. And he saw that as a answer to almost all of health, which he also thought was vulnerable. Your health was vulnerable to your stress level, and he thought modern life, particularly apartment life in large cities, was extremely stressful, and that this was, in effect, the antidote. And then he wrote, or somehow got involved with, he is the stated author of Return to Life, which is still in publication. And in that book, he espouses his exercises as medicine. It'll keep you healthy.
Now, some of these
prevent disease.
I'm sorry. Now, some of these exercises have very interesting names, like push the carriage and the teaser. Did you have a favorite?
Well, I get that asked a lot. Do I have a favorite? No, I don't have a favorite. I do have exercises that cause me more difficulty than others. And I would, you know, I have a natural instinct to dread them or not look forward to them. On the other hand, when I get through them, I also have a natural instinct to congratulate myself and say, "Oh God, you did that!" So they, for an instant, become a favorite. And but no, the whole notion of contrology or Pilates, to joke, was that you start this routine, this choreography, and from beginning to end, it's one thing. It's not, it's like if you see it as a piece of music, it's not the individual notes, it's the whole thing. It's the space between the notes and the notes and the doubling back and all of that, or like a complete ballet. So you really, as I got into it, at least under him and with other teachers much later and continuing to this day, I see it as one thing. So when I have a difficult passage, let's say, in it, it's just like a difficult passage in music. Yeah, you have to work on that particular thing a little harder. You have to, your focus even becomes, you know, more precise but you don't have the luxury of saying, "Oh, that was nice," or "That was not nice." So there is really no favorite.
His name is John Howard Steele. We're talking about his book, Caged Lion, Joseph Pilates and His Legacy. We'll be back with more of John after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Olivia, from Washington. Laid off and trying to keep our little kids from realizing that mommy and daddy haven't eaten in a while.
Roger, from California. I'm grateful we could afford our son's surgery. I'm nervous that now we can't really afford food.
Daniel, from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Donna, from Louisiana. The storm just hit, and we went from donating to the food bank to needing it.
Keisha, from South Carolina. I've been skipping meals so my two kids can eat, but filling up on water doesn't really work.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
America, your children have an amazing superpower. That's right. They can help save lives by simply washing their hands. Just 20 seconds of thorough hand washing after they've coughed or sneezed or been outside can help fight against the dastardly spread of germs. Armed with only soap and water and hands, your superhero can protect you, your family, and everyone out there in America land. Amazing! Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week is John Howard Steele. He's the author of Caged Lion, Joseph Pilates and His Legacy. When Joseph Pilates passed, how did you and his other friends and devotees continue the practice and keep the studio going?
Yeah, that was something that amazed us because when he did die, I and everyone else thought, oh my goodness, this is the end of it. And we did close the gym for a week. I remember handwriting a sign and putting it on the door. And then we reopened, and it was eerie in the sense that it was like he was still there. Everyone showed up. There weren't the social networks, there weren't cell phones. People just knew to come back. There were some communication. Now, I guess the few people we had communicated among themselves. And John Winter and Hannah came back, and Clara would come in, and it just kept going. It had its own life force. And yes, people did miss Joe, and yes, there was no way to do intake for new people. But for those of us who were familiar with the work, who knew the work, and who had been coming regularly for years, it was pretty much the same, and we when we needed help with anything, if we needed a push or if we got a little stuck or lost on where, what we should do, or we needed someone to tell us to flatten our back or point our toes or whatever, there was Hannah and John and Clara, and we just kept going. Now, it was managed originally. I guess I was sort of the focal point of the management because I was the only one that really was socially close to Clara. But then others came to my aid immediately. My father said, all right, what can we do? And Julie Clayburgh, Jill Clayburgh's mother and father, and a few, Dan Reed, who was a clothing manufacturer, Jim Lipton, maybe, I don't remember so much, Cy Coleman, there, whole group of these people said, well, let's get a little bit organized, and we'll just keep it going. And that's what we did. We got just a little bit organized. In fact, I think it was a period of almost delicious disorganization. It just kept going. And everyone was content, but you could see after a while that we had to make a couple changes. We just couldn't. It couldn't go on forever. And then, of course, the landlord intervened because Dan Cedar of Harlem wanted the space. And the landlord, I guess, wanted us out. I never dealt very much with the landlord. Clara dealt with him, and she said, we're going to lose the space.
Clara was his wife. For those who didn't read the book yet, Clara was his wife.
Yeah, except they weren't married. And that's in the book, too. And but she was definitely his wife. So we were up, you know, up against deadlines, and none of us selfishly were prepared to let it go because we wouldn't have a place to do Contrology. And that was such an important thing to all of us, unspokenly important. We just were motivated. So we moved to, we created a whole new studio. We hired Romana Krasnowska and built a beautiful studio on 56th Street between 5th and 6th. And try to revitalize it. That was our first attempt to really make it self-sufficient in a business way. I mean, it was self-sufficient under Joe and Clara, but that was mom and pop, 100%. So that's how it, you know, kept alive for long enough for this, its seed to spread to the West Coast, where it really got revitalized entirely by Ron Fletcher.
Now, there was a number of disruptions in that time, and they led to litigation. You had mentioned Romana. There was legalities involved. And ultimately, the practice per se, folks can read the book and learn the whole story, but ultimately the practice survived. There's a number of teachers that emerged over the years. Some of them gave their own spin to it. Did they stay true to the original practice?
Yeah, that's a very common inquiry. And there's still a split in the community. I maintain, yes, that the core of contrology is very much in almost every one of the 10,000 plus studios in the United States alone, and an equal or greater number throughout the rest of the world. And I can go to almost any one of them, and I can, first place, the equipment is functionally identical to the equipment Joe invented and built pretty close to 100 years ago. So that basically immediately tells you that there's a deep, deep connection. But there is a much deeper connection in the exercises, even in the exercises that are done without equipment, mat work. The movements, the fact that you have to concentrate on what you're doing. You can't jump on it's not like jumping on an exercise cycle or rowing machine and watching TV. You've got to think this thing through internally, not consciously. You've got to get in touch with yourself. You've got to concentrate on it. You got to feel the stretching. You got to feel the exercises. And I think when you get down to what's at the core of Pilates, Contrology, yes, they're all very, very much the same, and they build to one degree or another, depending a lot on the instructor or the school. They build on exactly what he left. It's a bit like classical music. I mean, when Bach wrote his stuff, the flute had one key on it, the piano was a harpsichord, the drums were totally different, the trumpets didn't have anything. And yet, when the New York Philharmonic plays Bach on all these instruments, you know it's Bach, number one, and your breath is taken away. Well, Pilates has a lot of that to it. It's built on a fundamentally brilliant series of movements.
If you could have a conversation with Joseph Pilates today, what would you say to him, and how do you think he'd respond?
Well, that is the last chapter in the book, because it's a wonderful thought of projection. First place, he'd go nuts. I mean, he was very strict on following his exact routine. He believed that his exact routine was the answer. He didn't appreciate that he had stumbled upon, if that's not a little too flippant, but if he had come across some very basic things about the human psyche and movement and exercise, he didn't appreciate that. So if you didn't follow his exact routine, he'd go crazy. So if he saw what was going on now, he would be absolutely beside himself. He'd need sedation. And I think with sufficient sedation, and if I was there next to him and I could get him calmed down enough and tell him that this is his dream, that he did want millions and millions of people all over the world to do this and enjoy it and to feel better about themselves, their lives, their families, their bodies, and that it had been accomplished through people that loved the work and loved him. And I think it might get through to him that, yes, this is how it had to happen.
Wonderful. His book is called Caged Lion, Joseph Pilates and His Legacies. John Howard Steele, one more time, please share with our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
You can get my book everyone easily can get it on Amazon. Best place in my mind during particularly these difficult times is go to, call your bookstore. Ask your bookstore for the book. If they don't have it, they'll get it for you in a day or so. Almost all of them will bring it out to the curb. You'll have your book. You'll help your local bookstore. That's a great way to get this book. But if the easy way, the fast way, Amazon, and there's nothing wrong with doing it that way. It's the paragon of efficiency. And so that's what capitalism rewards. So you can go to Amazon. If you go to my website, you'll learn a lot more about the book, somewhat about me. The website is johnhowardsteele.com, and there's a click through on that to Amazon, and I think you'll enjoy it. It's a good read.
John, absolutely delightful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Victor. We're going to resume this somewhere else soon, I hope.
Absolutely. And thank you for joining us on Vox Novus. I'm Victor, the voice, Furman. Have a wonderful week.